Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The next two talks are going to focus on critical limb ischemia. The first will be Dave Dawson, professor at UC Davis Vascular Surgery. He's going to talk to us about endo as the first-line treatment. Dave?
Good to see you. Thanks. Thanks, Peter. Chris? So my assigned topic is really supposed to be, I think, a counterpoint to the next talk by Dr. Conti. And this is kind of how I feel. Here's Mike. And here's me. So I do want to maybe level the playing field a little bit by revising the presentation to, first of all, accept that Mom and Apple Pie would state that a selective approach to anything probably works best, but endovascular should be considered first-line therapy for CLI. Now, I do have consultant-speaker research relationships as listed here, but no commercial content or discussion of devices is in this particular presentation. My other disclosure is that I am a vascular surgeon, and when I trained, the most common operation I did was revascularization of the lower extremity, and the most common category of operation was tibial bypass, and that's the way I started my practice. But now things are a little bit different, and also because I am at University of California, Davis, which started out as a university farm, I'm required by university policy to use a produce metaphor. And so what we had is a situation where we were comparing apples and oranges, and in the year 2000, surgery clearly was the dominant strategy for treating CLI. And in 2010, that ratio has reversed. So what I'd like to do is talk about five key questions. First of all, what are the results of lower extremity bypass in surgical candidates, excluding those perhaps at highest risk for adverse outcomes in contemporary series? Why not surgery first? And compare then the results from an endovascular first strategy for CLI. And then examine, does this burn bridges? And what would you do in real world practice? So if we look at the data that are available for contemporary results of lower extremity bypass grafts for CLI, we can look to a recent paper in the Journal of Vascular Surgery that reported on two groups. One was the group of patients that was used to develop the SVS objective performance goals. These OPGs were calculated from the surgical arms of five multi-center randomized trials for CLI. And these surgical series included those patients who had autologous vein available for bypass, because that was the nature of the trial. And they excluded patients with end-stage renal disease on dialysis because, as they said, they had a disproportionately poor outcome. Also, are the data from the Vascular Study Group of New England. These are self-reported data on almost 2,900 lower extremity bypass procedures between 2003 and 2009. But these patients did not include those treated for claudication, those with a prosthetic conduit, actually a fifth of those revascularized, or those operated on for aneurysm. They also excluded patients on dialysis and those lost to follow-up. So here are the data. Most of the patients being revascularized for CLI had diabetes. So diabetes is not a minor component. It's actually the norm in these populations. 12 to 14% had previous ipsilateral surgical revascularization procedures, and about twice that number had either surgical or endovascular revascularization. 15 to 16% were considered to be clinical high risk, which they defined as age over 80 or tissue loss. Most of these were anatomic high risk, which they defined as a tibial target. 10% in the VSGNE and 27% in the SVS cohort were considered high-risk conduit in that they didn't have a single piece of ipsilateral or a single piece of adequate quality great saphenous vein. These are the one-year data. So we see that at 1 year, about one quarter had some major adverse limb event or postoperative death. Limb loss was seen in approximately 10%, and 8 to 14% died within 1 year. The reintervention, amputation, or graft stenosis rate was a third in the VSGNE group, and it was about a half in the SVS group. So these data confirm, if nothing else, that CLI is a bad problem and that there is a less than optimal outcome for many. We still think that surgical bypass is the option of choice for those who have good conduit and who are adequate or perhaps optimal candidates for operation. But bypass provides reasonably effective and durable revascularization for CLI only in those patients selected for surgical treatment. What that means is that we're uncertain about what the recommendations are for patients with renal failure, or what about those who don't have conduit, or poor functional status, or limited life expectancy, or perhaps, and not listed here, those who need only temporary patency to achieve a good clinical outcome. This is what we call the real world. So optimum outcomes are actually rare with surgery. This was first, I think, pointed out by the group from Oregon who looked at their outcomes at 42 months. A lot of these patients became independent or continued to be independent, but wound complications were seen in a quarter, repeat operations in a half. And at 1 year, an ideal surgical result, which they defined as having an uncomplicated operation, long-term symptom relief, maintenance of functional status, and no recurrent or repeat operations, was only seen in 14%. Some never benefit. If you look at the VSG&E data on a different paper, they looked at 1 year after bypass, despite having a patent graft, 10% still had amputation or persistent or worsened ischemic symptoms, and they concluded that further emphasis needs to be placed on functional outcomes in addition to those traditional surgical outcomes. Naylor and colleagues in the Journal of Vascular Surgery highlighted the limitations of surgical revascularization, pointing out that CLI patients, half of them are dead at 5 years if you look at surgical series, and the mortality is worse if you look at other series. Surgical care should be considered palliative, and it may be that the outcomes data from published series lacks generalizability. They talked about the important functional impact of surgical complications and quoted the late John Porter as saying, "The last decades in limb salvage surgery, we discovered what we could do. Now it's time to learn what we should do." So what about endovascular first? Well, endovascular is often an outpatient procedure, and it avoids the surgical morbidities of incision, nerve injury, lymphedema, and pain. And because of that, it is the choice of most patients and referring providers. What are the data? Well, I think many groups have adopted an endovascular first strategy. I think one of the first publications that really looked prospectively at this in any kind of way was the Basel trial, and their endovascular first approach was compared to surgery, and they found similar amputation-free survival rates. And we've adopted this approach in our practice, and I think this reflects the 2011 consensus recommendations from the European Society for Vascular Surgery. We looked at our data. It actually came out in a review that was published last year in the Journal of Vascular Surgery of our interventions for CLI over a 24-month period. Now, this study was actually performed to evaluate whether duplex scan findings after infrainguinal endovascular interventions for CLI were predictive of reintervention or amputation. But the review did provide an insight on the overall safety and efficacy of this strategy. And this is a summary of the data from that paper. There are two groups, one who had normal duplex ultrasound after CLI interventions and another that had an abnormal finding on a follow-up duplex. And what we found is that the primary patency at 12 months was 65% if they had a good result by duplex criteria and less than 50% if they had an abnormal duplex. We found that the reinterventions were not uncommon, and amputation was seen in 5% of those who had CLI with a good duplex result and 20% that had an abnormal result. And this was statistically significant, indicating that that abnormal post-op, post-procedure vascular laboratory examination is predictive of outcome in these patients. Importantly, we also saw that 18% were dead at 1 year, at 12 months, 18%, but there was a 0% 30-day mortality rate. So we didn't have procedural deaths, but these patients died of their relatively malignant disease. These are life tables from that paper. The primary patency on the left is shown for those with a normal post-procedure duplex and then those with an abnormal post-procedure duplex, and amputation in those with normal and abnormal duplex. Well, let's compare these to the VSG&E data for lower extremity bypass. The primary patency was called freedom from reintervention, amputation, or graft stenosis, and amputation was called limb salvage in that paper. The data I will show you is not really a life table, but these are the the thresholds that were the 12-month outcomes. 46% at 1 year for bypass, and limb salvage, 89% at 1 year. So maybe we aren't talking about apples and apples. Revascularization outcomes, are they impacted by prior therapy? Yes, they are. Endovascular first, does it do harm? Well, if we look at VSG&E data from lower extremity bypasses, a paper by Nolan et al. Found that prior infrainguinal revascularization procedures, both endovascular and operative, did affect outcome, and it didn't necessarily affect the 30-day major adverse event rate or one-year mortality, but at 1 year, major amputation and 1 year graft occlusion rates were higher in patients who had had prior interventions than those without. And independent multivariate predictors of higher one-year amputation and graft occlusion rates were prior ipsilateral intervention, prior ipsilateral bypass, dialysis dependence, use of prosthetic conduit, or tibial target. So in essence, they found that any failure of prior revascularization or renal failure was predictive of a poorer outcome. Well, what are the specific risks of an endovascular first strategy? There is a risk of embolization, and the risk of embolization may vary with different endovascular techniques. They may be apples and oranges. And occlusion of an outflow artery that could be used as a surgical target is an undesired outcome. In fact, here's a specific case example of someone who had forefoot ischemia who was referred to me for care after someone had intervened on his posterior tibial artery and had stacked four stents in what was really a nice target vessel and rendered it no longer a viable surgical target. It's important to preserve the collaterals. We can still consider the profunda femoris, the lifeline of the lower extremity, lower limb, and are a bit concerned about the potential that certain types of stents, for example, covered stents, may be associated with an increased risk of severe ischemia when they do fail. And so I think it is important for the treating physician to be aware of what the patient's current surgical options are and what future revascularization options may be. So what would a vascular surgeon choose now in the era when we have little or no level one data and very little in the way of evidence-based guidelines to give us specific recommendations for specific patients who need revascularization for CLI? I think it's important to consider the basic data underlying the clinical decision-making. You should choose a trusted treatment strategy. Seek care in the centers that have the technical ability to provide that care. And the treatment does, I would agree, need to be individualized to the individual patient. So bypass only, surgery only, endovascular treatment only. If you've only got one tool, then all the world looks like that particular target. But the modern vascular specialist, I think, has a variety of tools in the toolkit. What we need to do is get a little bit smarter about which one to pull out first. But right now, we're still using a minimally invasive approach first.
So now we'll invite Mike Conti back up to provide another point of view.
I'll start out by saying that that was a great talk, and I think we agree on most points. What I'm going to show you, though, is a little bit more about what I think is actually happening, not in the ideal world, but in the real world, where the endo-first mentality, I think, has been promulgated beyond where it's being ideally applied, and that is one of my concerns. So I have no disclosures for this talk. I'm going to start out with a case discussion so you get a chance to vote. This is a case just from about 6 weeks ago. It's a 58-year-old diabetic with coronary artery disease and hypertension. He presented to us after having bounced around for about a month with a week of worsening right foot rest pain. He had erythema and gangrenous changes involving his third and fourth toes and no pedal pulses. He had a history of stable coronary disease, status post of previous PCI. He had no previous peripheral interventions. He had an intact greater saphenous vein that you could see quite nicely there below his knee. He got an angiogram, which I'll show you. He needed a drainage amputation of toes 3 through 5. This is what his foot looked like. And you can see on the plantar surface. And he had some cellulitis that's not so evident here, but was at the level of the ankle. I'm going to apologize because the lack of overlap is, the overlap's not perfect here, but what you can see, actually the symptomatic side is his right on your left, where he has an open SFA down to the adductor canal. Then it completely occludes right at the adductor canal. Popliteal artery is completely occluded. And then he's reconstituting at the level of essentially the terminus of the TP trunk. And he has an AT and a PT, both going down to the ankle and foot, with the PT being the dominant vessel. So, what would you do first? Attempt recanalization of his popliteal and TP trunk using a transluminal or subintimal angioplasty. Perhaps do an atherectomy of his popliteal or TP trunk. That's choice B. Choice C, do a femoral to tibial bypass using greater saphenous vein. Go ahead and vote. Okay, I don't have so much hard work then this morning. So not everybody is going to try to take a guide wire and cross this lesion. Why? Not because it might be impossible, but because it really doesn't make any sense. Okay, let's talk about why. So what are we trying to do with CLI? We're not talking about patency. Patients don't care about patency. They care about relieving their pain, healing their wounds, and preserving a functional limb. And the way that we achieve this, we believe, is effective revascularization. But we also need to pay attention to their cardiovascular event rate, which is high, by giving them effective medical therapies and lifestyle modification. Well, we have tried and true bypass. It's been around for several decades, and it's an effective treatment choice for CLI. But now we have an increasing array of tools that we can bring to bear on patients with more severe lower extremity disease to allow us to reopen occluded arteries, reline them, and achieve at least technical success. The question is, with this plethora of techniques, what do we actually do in everyday practice? And it's become increasingly confusing. Clearly, people are voting with their feet, although the reasons for this are not always clear, or maybe they are clear. But what you can see is that the increase in endovascular intervention has outpaced the decline in bypass surgery by more than 3-1. Now, the disease is increasing a little bit, but not that much. And I think we know that it's a little bit of this, too, that there's a revolving door of people getting endo-only all the time, and when they're finally spit out at the end of this revolving door, sometimes there's nothing left to do. Or their options are a lot worse than when they started, as Dave just pointed out. And there's a lot of factors involved in this, but evidence is not really high on the list. So what do I look at when I'm looking at a patient with CLI in the office? These are the things that I consider carefully. What's their overall health, their age, their comorbidities? Do they walk? How ambulatory are they? I think it's important, and we as vascular surgeons can appreciate this probably more than our interventional colleagues, is the likelihood of functional salvage of the foot. How severe is the ischemia? How hemodynamically severe is the ischemia? What's the anatomic distribution of disease? Have they had a previous intervention? And what kind of vein do they have available? And you can determine almost all of this in your first office visit, and this is really how I base primarily in combination with the angiogram, my decisions. So I want to point out about being careful with some of the apples and oranges comparisons that Dave showed, because obviously limb salvage is the goal of CLI, and this is a limb salvage curve from a population of patients in a well-characterized clinical trial. These were, in fact, patients in the CIRCULACE trial, almost 400 patients with CLI proven hemodynamically who were felt to have no option for revascularization. That's why they were given an unproven medical therapy, which didn't actually work. But in this no-option population, surprisingly, their limb salvage at 1 year was 87%. These patients basically got aspirin. Now, most of them had res pain or minor tissue loss. But the thing I want to point out to you is that when you look at this data and you're comparing studies that were not randomized, don't be swayed by limb salvage data alone, because it's a very insensitive measure of the quality of revascularization unless patients are randomized and followed for a long time. And in fact, sustained hemodynamic improvement is, as Dr. Schneider pointed out, what we're trying to achieve. It is the most direct measure of effective revascularization. Okay, so here's the task scheme again. You heard it before. Surgery is supposed to be first treatment of choice for TASD. Why is that? It's based on the compendium of evidence that we have, that for disease that's extensive, long segment, and the femoropopliteal segment, failure rates are exceedingly high for endovascular treatment. But I will admit that this is limited in its scope and its current application to practice. And I pointed out before that the caveat here is that this is really driven by the endovascular failure problem. Vein quality is the primary factor in lower extremity bypass success. It's not even on the graphic. And the other point is that most patients with CLI have multi-level disease. TASC 2 has limited relevance for them. Treatment really should be limb and patient-specific and not lesion-focused. So we know a lot about infraringual bypass. It's the gold standard. It's been documented in many reports. It's versatile. It allows us to treat a variety of complex anatomies and patient circumstances. It has low mortality and good durability. But yes, for sure, it has real limitations and risks. Wound complications occur in 10 to 20% of patients. Recovery can be long. Not everybody has a good vein. It requires surveillance and reintervention. And in fact, this is one of the most underrated, technically demanding procedures in cardiovascular surgery. We do know a lot about the outcomes. This is the PREVENT 3 trial, 1,400 patients at 83 hospitals across North America. These patients had bypass surgery for bona fide CLI. This is not a low-risk study. And I just want to point out the 30-day event rates that you can expect from modern, well-done bypass surgery is a death rate of under 3%, early graft occlusion of 5%, early amputation of 2%. Remember those numbers. This cohort had 75% of the patients had tissue loss, a quarter of them were high-risk conduits, and two-thirds were below the knee grafts. And at 1 year, roughly, the primary patency rate in a study that included aggressive graft surveillance was about 60%. Primary assisted and secondary were about 78 to 80%. And 15% of the patients had a mortality within 1 year, as pointed out by Dave. Okay, what happens if you have a reasonable vein? I think it's important to bring this right to the forefront. This was almost half of the PREVENT 3 study. 604 bypasses had a single segment of vein of diameter of 3.5 millimeters. The 30-day failure rate's 2%, a primary patency 72%, secondary almost 90%. And this stresses the importance of assessing the conduit before you start moving your guide wire through things. You need to know if the patient has a good vein because this is an important factor. And in fact, if you have a good vein, it doesn't matter if you go to the knee or below. The results are equivalent. Femoropopliteal or distal bypass grafts, there's no difference by the level of anastomosis if you have a good vein and it's done by a qualified vascular surgeon. So this means that you should really look at the quality of vein before you make decisions based only on the angiogram. Okay, but not everybody does well, and I think Dr. Schanzer will talk about this later today. We looked at the PREVENT 3 data. We've looked at other data. There's a few risk scores out there. They're appropriate. Some patients who get bypass surgery, we haven't done them any favors. If you looked at some risk factors, simple ones like age, anemia, coronary disease, dialysis, advanced tissue loss, and you combine these into a score, the patients who had a very high score, more than 8 points, their amputation-free survival at 1 year was less than 50%. That's not very good for patients who've been put through a major operation. However, I want to point out that this is only about 10% of the whole study cohort. And when they looked at the same exact score within that vascular surgery group of Northern New England data, they found exactly the same thing. But it was only about 6% of the patients that they had selected to undergo bypass surgery. We should make efforts to find these patients because they really didn't get served very well, and I think a high-risk group is real, but if you're a careful surgeon and you're selecting your patients properly, it's usually a minority. Endovascular therapy has a lot of potential advantages, and we heard earlier this morning about the great promise if we can fix restenosis, which is the real deal in terms of the magnitude of the diseases we're treating as CLI. The advantages, less invasive, faster recovery, we've all seen that. However, there are some real potential disadvantages. I want to point out some of them. Reduced efficacy, not only in terms of durability, but even the immediate hemodynamic bang for the buck may be limited. There is real risk of limb deterioration that can affect surgical options. You saw a perfect picture of that. And there's cost, not only to the system with repeated treatments, but to the patients coming back over and over again with decreasing symptom-free intervals. Unfortunately, when you try to figure this out and you're reading papers, the techniques are often not standardized and the results are often relatively short follow-up and very heterogeneous cohorts. There has been some increasing quality of data. This is a meta-analysis of infrapopliteal angioplasty for CLI, and it shows reasonable results. In general, the outcomes in terms of comparing angioplasty for bypass has superior patency rates at and primary and secondary patency rates. The limb salvage, although remember what I told you about comparing apples and oranges, looks reasonable, and I think it meets the reasonableness criteria, but it's not as good. And what are some of the factors that come up over and over again with inferior results for endovascular treatment? Limb salvage, occlusion, TAS C and D disease, multi-level disease, poor runoff, diabetes, and elevated creatinine. This, unfortunately, is most of the patients in my office with CLI. They have one, two, three, or more of these factors. They generally are not great endovascular candidates. Well, I don't want to, and I didn't make this x-ray up. This is a real deal. I mean, You saw another perfect picture from Dave. Anybody who stands up in front of you and says that no bridges are burned, this is now, I would say, in the category of a reckless fallacy. They are either in frank denial, don't have a practice, or are on the company payroll. I think we have concerns about increasing use of stents, which may and are compromising inflow and outflow targets. It may influence runoff. Embolization can occur and does occur. I think we've all seen it in our practice. And I think what's underestimated is what this does to the patients. You know, another toe, a little more tissue loss, a little more pain, and another procedure. It's not minor. Now, here's what's happening in the real world. It's not all happening in careful centers like UC Davis, unfortunately. Here's the data from the U.S. Medicare population on tibioperoneal interventions for critical limb ischemia. This is a large Medicare database, and they looked only at 30-day outcomes. So the 30-day mortality was about 7%. The rehospitalization rate was about 30%. Within 30 days, patients needed repeat angiograms, repeat interventions, and bypass, a significant number here. But here's the most alarming thing to me. The 30-day amputation rate, you can see on this slide, below knee or above knee, is relatively high, 23% at any level, and a 17% major amputation rate in the so-called Rutherford 6 patients. And this is almost the same outcome from a different data set. This is the nationwide inpatient sample, more than 500,000 procedures. They showed how costs have increased by 50% due to an increased volume of endovascular treatments for CLI. The mortality rates for bypass surgery and angioplasty are about the same, but the major amputation rates for angioplasty and stenting were 7% overall and 18% within 30 days for Rutherford 6 patients. So I would suggest to you that as it's going on in current practice in the United States, the large data set suggests that there's early amputation rates that are high. It may be poor judgment, it may be Hail Mary passes, it may be failures, but they're high, especially in patients with significant tissue loss. So finally, what's the only randomized trial we have? It's the BASIL trial. It's a little bit dated now. It's a decade old. It's in the UK. 450 patients were randomized to angioplasty first versus surgery first. I still can't figure out exactly how they picked these patients. It was only about a third of all the patients they saw with advanced limb ischemia, but their primary endpoint was amputation-free survival. And as you heard, their initial results suggested that the outcomes in terms of overall survival on the right and amputation-free survival on the left were essentially equivalent, but the curves separated at 2 years. And based on that, they had a longer-term follow-up study. I also want to point out that despite some of the nihilism that you sometimes hear, this study very nicely shows that more than 70% of limb salvage patients live beyond 2 years. So you need to keep in mind for most of these patients that they do need some durability in these outcomes. When they looked at the outcome based on the treatment actually received within the first 8 weeks, because there was actually a fair amount of crossover to bypass, and you have to be careful about this analysis, but they did show that patients who got their bypass with vein, not surprisingly, there was 25% of patients in this surgery arm had a prosthetic. They did not do very well. And patients who had their bypass done initially compared to patients who got it after a failed angioplasty, there was a significant decrement in the outcome of the bypass done after failed angioplasty. And this was done in only an angioplasty environment. There was no metal left behind. There was no atherectomy. One wonders in the real world, after all the kinds of treatments that are really going on, what's this going to do to the outcomes of bypass surgery? And these investigators concluded, after all of this, that bypass with vein offered the best long-term amputation-free and overall survival, and angioplasty appears superior to a prosthetic bypass. And today, I would essentially agree with these conclusions, and that's what the data supports. And I think that they were the first to show this, and Dave showed also that we already know that doing a redo bypass, that's a higher risk situation, but it turns out that if you do a bypass after a failed endo, it's the same thing. It's almost as bad as if they've already had a bypass. The risk of them having a successful bypass at long term appears to be impacted by a previous endovascular failure. The reasons are not clear, and this could be just an association for sure. But what I don't want to see is that this become the results of what all bypass surgery is going to look like if everybody only gets their bypass after endovascular has failed. So I'll end by saying, is this basal trial relevant to practice in 2011? Well, yes, because it's the only level one evidence, unfortunately, we have in the field. This is the opportunity that we need to address right now. And also because plain old balloon angioplasty is still a dominant treatment in below-the-knee vessels. This study was the first to show the potential negative effects of endoluminal therapy if it fails, and it does confirm that for a significant proportion of patients, durability is important and life expectancy should be considered before selecting the initial strategy. But the results of both bypass and endovascular and basal are probably not reflective of current outcomes, at least in U.S. practice, and I think it's hard to interpret because the cohort was highly selected. So in conclusion, this is how I currently practice. I look at surgical risk, life expectancy, the severity of ischemia, the anatomy, and the availability of vein. And when it's an average risk surgical patient who I think is likely to be alive for 2 years or more, when they have more severe tissue loss and poor hemodynamics and severe anatomic disease, if they have a vein, I favor bypass first. But if any of these other situations exist, particularly if they have minor tissue loss, less severe hemodynamics, and more favorable anatomy, and especially if they have an inadequate vein, I favor endo first. And right now in my practice, this is about 60-40, and that's where I currently sit until somebody shows me some better evidence to suggest that endo is going to work better. And of course, there are patients who really should be considered for primary amputation or palliation because they have poor functional status and should not be treated with aggressive revascularization. So this was the original group. I'll show you what ultimately we did in this patient. He got, as expected, a bypass to his posterior tibial artery and had a successful completion TMA. Thank you for your time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.